Near the summit of Mount Everest in the Death Zone, on the ridge of the North Face, is a shallow cave known infamously as the cave where a gentleman named Sawang Paljor laid. He is known as Green Boots. In 1996, he perished there during the storm that took 8 lives on the south side and 3 others on the north side. Almost exactly 10 years later to the day, David Sharp, a young man of 34 from England, sat down in the same shallow cave, never to get back up again. Climbers passing by were shocked to see another person sitting inside the cave. Reportedly, a team passed by late that evening, and Sharp was said to have waved them on by that he was okay. But dozens of other climbers passed him by on their way to or returning from the summit. Many reported that they never saw him at all, and some reported that there was nothing they could do. The following morning, Jamie McGinnis, who was working as a guide on another expedition team, sat down with Dawa Sherpa. Dawa had just returned from the summit, and he stopped in the shallow cave where David Sharp was sitting, and he did everything in his power to try to get Sharp to stand up and get down the mountain. And Jamie tells me that Dawa sat there and cried, and that there was nothing that he could do, no matter how hard he tried, to save David Sharp. Today, I'm going to talk about David Sharp and the sad story associated with his death. When the news got out, there was a worldwide furor. David Sharp, he'd been left to die, supposedly, as reported in the media, by a group of selfish climbers focused only on the summit. Even Sir Edmund Hillary himself lashed out at the changes that had taken place in mountaineering over the years since he first had climbed the mountain in 1953. Were the climbers selfish, or did David Sharp get himself into a place that would have been impossible to be rescued in? Today we're going to talk about David Sharp, and we're going to have some input from Jamie McGinnis, who was on the mountain that day, also a friend of David Sharp, and also some insight from Russell Bryce, known as the mayor of Everest Base Camp, had a team on the mountain that day, who also was the person who ended up calling David Sharp's parents to report that he had died on the mountain. So first, I'll give a brief description of the conditions on Mount Everest, particularly during this time, which was reported to have been a very extreme period of time on the mountain. And then I'll share information and insights from an interview that I did with Jamie McGinnis, who was on the mountain. He was a friend of David Sharp and was the person who spoke with several of the individuals who saw David Sharp on the night that he died. And also some information from Russell Bryce, who I have been in contact with about that story. Then I'll share some of the media attention that it was given around the world after news let out about the death of David Sharp. And lastly, I'll share my thoughts on mistakes that I think might have been made and come to a conclusion on if there's anything that might have been done differently that could have saved his life. And I'd like to hear your comments if you're familiar with the story of David Sharp. If you remember when you first heard about the story, did it create rage in your mind, or did you understand that it's very difficult to save somebody who's dying in the death zone? And before we get to the story, please take a moment to subscribe and hit the bell icon so you'll be notified every time a new video comes out on Everest Mystery. And also consider becoming a member of this channel. You can support the work that I do on Everest Mystery so I can put out more videos like this. These videos, I look to inspire and give you thought-provoking videos that make your life just a little bit better. The conditions on Mount Everest year-round are extreme. However, there's a short window in the month of May that makes the weather calm down and also warm up a little bit, leaving an opportunity for climbers to get to the summit and back down again without any extreme weather. Some years there are many summit days, and other years those windows are very small. If you were to be placed on the summit of Mount Everest, having come from sea level, you would lose your life in a matter of minutes. The atmospheric pressure on the summit of Mount Everest is one-third that as it is at sea level. And so what would happen first is you would experience extreme hypoxia, have difficulty breathing, dizziness, inability to think straight. Those hypoxia symptoms would increase until you lost consciousness some minutes later, and without immediate intervention and somebody administering oxygen to you and helping you move your way back down the mountain, within 30 minutes at the least, you would be dead. Jamie McGinnis, who was on the mountain at the time that David Sharp lost his life, reported to me that the temperatures there, which normally are between 15 below zero Fahrenheit or 26 below zero centigrade, it was much colder than that. He called it savagely cold. So the temperatures could have been 30 or 40 below zero on that particular night, which makes things a lot more difficult. I have a full interview with Jamie about his experiences on the mountain on that time that David Sharp lost his life. It's in my podcast called The Happiness Quotient, and I'll put that link in the description of this video. I'm going to use as much as I can of Jamie's input from that interview to help put this story together. David Sharp was a 34-year-old English mountaineer. He died near the summit of Mount Everest. It was on the north side, the Tibetan side of the mountain, and it was in a shallow cave on the northeast ridge at an altitude of about 8,500 meters. That's 27,890 feet. This is below what's known as the first step on Mount Everest. It's the same location of the body of Sawang Paljor, the Indian gentleman referred to as Green Boots. David did have experience in 8,000 meter peak climbing. In 2002, he was on Cho-O-Yu. Jamie McGinnis was also guiding an expedition on Cho-O-Yu at the same time, and he got to know David very well. And one of the things he relayed to me is that David was going on a super low budget expedition, and the company that he hired for support, he said, look, I don't want cooks, I don't want anything, just get me the things that I need on the mountain, including food, and then we'll cook our own food. So when they got to base camp, the food was in fact there, but they learned that it was rice flour, and David and the others on the team had no clue how to cook with rice flour. So Jamie went out to another expedition and found a cook who was interested in helping them prepare their food. So the cook would cook for his expedition and then go over to David Sharp's base camp and cook the food over there for them. So that started a friendship between them. And Jamie said he was a really good guy, very smart, bright, intelligent. The next year in 2003, David was on Mount Everest, adamant that he did not want a guide to help at all. So Jamie became essentially a Sherpa on that expedition. Now we're talking about Sherpa with a lowercase s. On that particular expedition, David Sharp started to get frostbite, and so a lot of the people in that group, along with David Sharp, decided to turn around. He lost several toes due to the frostbite on that expedition. He returned in 2004, and he got to 8,500 meters, coincidentally very close to the shallow cave where Green Boots is and where David ended up in 2006. He did get frostbite on his fingers on that expedition and again was turned back without any summit in the bag. And so he planned to return 2 years later. But this time in 2006, his goal was to go without oxygen and without any Sherpa support. So essentially a solo expedition to Mount Everest, which is obviously considered an extremely risky move. I reported on the 2023 disappearance of Suhaida Szilard, who was the Hungarian climber going without any oxygen and without any support, nobody with him to help him out just in case something went down. David got a bare bones package from a company known as Asian Trekking, and it was really just no support on the mountain. They would get his equipment up there or any that he needed, and then that was it. He was on his own up the mountain. And so Jamie asked David to meet him in Kathmandu before the expedition, and over a beer at a bar called Sam's, he said, "Look, I know what you paid Asian Trekking. Why don't you come onto our expedition? I will charge you almost nothing more than what they're charging you. Come with us. It will be safer." However, as Jamie said, it was under the condition, as Jamie said, there would be a constraint that when we go for the summit, everything would have to be in place, meaning the team would be ready to go, that Jamie would call the shots. And also part of those constraints is that there were going to be climbing Sherpas with that team. And so what David said is like, "Wow, that is an amazing offer, but I won't do it because I'm unwilling to go with those constraints. I don't want any Sherpa support. I want to be on my own and do it the way I want to do it. Thank you, but no thanks."
On May 14th, David Sharp left for the summit.
Jamie was well down the mountain at advanced base camp. Now, it's not known whether David Sharp made it to the summit or not. Many people surmise that he didn't, but Jamie believes that he did and thinks that he probably made the summit, if he did, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Many people know about that 2 o'clock turnaround time, but if it was 4 o'clock without oxygen, it might as well be the middle of the night on the moon. And as Jamie says it, on the night that David went for the summit, it was savagely cold. That is a word that you don't want used for the conditions when you go to the summit of Mount Everest. Given that it was so late in the afternoon, on his way back down, Jamie surmises that he got to the cave where Green Boots was, and he sat down to take a rest. There is a recreation of the scene from a movie that they did about David Sharp, and I'll credit it here, and I'll show just a very brief clip of it, just so you can kind of get the setting of the time. This is not real. This is a recreation. This is not really David Sharp. And as Jamie says, when the temperatures are so cold, like 30 or 40 below zero, and does it even matter if it's Fahrenheit or Celsius at that point, it just cuts through everything and really beats you down. And oxygen is one of the vital elements to help you stay warm in conditions like that. And of course, David had none, not even a backup oxygen tank and regulator just in case of emergencies. So David is sitting there essentially hunched over with his arms up on his knees, motionless, and a number of teams were going up toward the summit, passing him. Some looked in and saw him. Apparently, he waved them on one of the first groups that went past. And then a very well-known team of Russell Bryces was with a climber named Mark Inglis, who became the first double amputee to summit Mount Everest. Now, Russell Bryce was down in base camp and in communication with his team. And when they went by, they were filming the TV show Beyond the Limit. And apparently, there is footage on some of the Sherpas' head cameras. They had GoPros on their head, and a guide named Mark Fetu also filmed up there. But apparently, that footage has never been released. The parents have seen it, and then it was never to be released to the public. And Jamie said that another team that went by was a Turkish team. It was a large group of climbers. He's not sure if that was the first Turks to summit Mount Everest or not, but he talked to them after this thing took place, and he said that they walked past and they just said to him, "Don't sit down for too long. You better keep moving, keep going." And they thought he was on his way up the mountain, not on his way down the mountain. Jamie was convinced that all was copacetic and that those guys did their due diligence and really had no idea just how severe the situation was. Mark Inglis, who was ultimately called out by Sir Edmund Hillary, of all people, reported first off that they made radio communications down to Russell Bryce to let Russell know that they had seen somebody sitting in the cave. Russell Bryce immediately said that that was not true, that there was no report of them having seen anybody up the mountain. As Mark Inglis said sometime later, he said, "Sometimes your memory fails you. I guess I thought we called down on the radio, but we didn't." And so back to that story, as Jamie is coming up from the North Col toward Camp 2, he sees his friend Dawa Sherpa, who had been with David Sharp for about a half an hour with one of the Sherpa from Russell Bryce's team, doing everything in their power to try to save David, to try to get David to stand up and get down the mountain. And when he sat there with Jamie, he cried and cried. He said he was trying to help him stand up. He was slurring. He couldn't speak. And he knew it was frostbite that he had seen, because he reported that there was blackening going up beyond his wrists into his forearm, and he couldn't move his legs or stand up or straighten them out. And so Dawa was in tears as he relayed this to Jamie, because he knew when he got up to leave, he was leaving David Sharp to die. So the real controversy began shortly after, when news of David Sharp's death reached the media and people found out that there were other people passing him on their way to and from the summit. It created an international furor over the situation, that climbers were selfish and only thinking of themselves. And even Sir Edmund Hillary weighed in and said, "The world has changed. Mountaineering was never that way when I climbed the mountain in 1953, which is true. There's one team on the mountain at a time. So granted, it is a different situation. Many surmise, no matter what, that it would have been almost impossible to save David Sharp. Some rescues take 10 or 15, even 20 different people working in unison to share the load, if you will, of getting a person either in a stretcher or to be dragged down the mountain to share oxygen with that person. So it might have taken a gargantuan task even to just start moving the body. And even then, there's no telling if he would have survived or not. The repercussions of what appeared to be a heartless showing of human indignity, it just became worldwide news. And the climbers, many of the climbers, were condemned around the world. The interesting focus, again, was on Mark Inglis, who had become the first double amputee to summit. And Sir Edmund Hillary said it was the selfish behavior of a modern generation of climbers whose aim is to get to the summit without concern for the welfare of anybody along the way. And Inglis was gutted that Ed Hillary pointed him out. He said as a kid growing up, he had always looked up to Sir Edmund Hillary. Now, why was Inglis looking at Ed Hillary like a hero? Because he also was from New Zealand. So this is probably one of the most emotional high points and low points in Inglis's life. I can't put blame on anybody who was up there for not having saved David Sharp. I think that he was too far gone. And when you're up there, as Jamie McGinnis says, in savagely cold conditions, while you might be a guide and exceptionally stronger and more able than your clients, you have the immediate charge of your clients to worry about. And so to put any focus on guides or clients in that situation, I think, is rather unfair. And so in terms of the overall wrap-up and observations of what took place, we know that David Sharp had gone low budget, bottom of the barrel, climbing on Mount Everest that year, no oxygen, no support, no Sherpa support on the mountain. That is putting yourself out at the end of a limb. And given the fact that it was his third attempt on Everest, he very well knew what it was like up high on the mountain there. And so also another thing to add into that, he refused the opportunity to take another oxygen bottle with a mask. Now that would be 5 kilos or 10 or 12 pounds in weight, and he also did not want to bring with him a radio. Those are two things that very well might have saved his life. Granted, it would have added weight in his backpack, but if it comes down to life or death, that would have been weight that I think most people would say would be worth the effort. And now, in terms of that overall observation, it is very easy to judge somebody from sea level and say, this is what should have taken place on the mountain. But the conditions in the death zone are so vastly different, you can't even explain it in words. You have to be there. Just imagine the absolute most sick you've ever felt in your entire life, the worst flu, with the inability to even roll over in bed and your whole body aches. That's a good day up there. Now, while I'm not judging David Sharp, I think a lot of his fate was really in his own hands. And while many of the mountaineers who went by him that day were judged very harshly, I think that that's an unfair deduction to make. Even David Sharp's mother, Linda, said that it was the right thing to do, that those climbers needed to take care of themselves first and foremost, and that David knew what he was doing. Now, David Sharp, again, was on a low-budget expedition, and it was Asian Trekking, notoriously expedition company that has not just David Sharp among their ranks of clients who have died on the mountain. This is not unusual for low-budget expedition operators to essentially set their clients free on their own up on the mountain. Now, David Sharp did carry a brunt of the responsibility. He knew what he was doing, supposedly. It was his third time on the mountain. He had frostbitten toes on one, frostbitten fingers on the other, and knew that he was up against a gargantuan task, going without oxygen or any support. And like I did in my video about Szilard Suhajda, the Hungarian climber, when you go out with not even a person, a friend, or some Sherpa support or support essentially nearby to notify you that you're losing your mind and can't make the right decisions, then you've stepped into the realm of the unknown. And any death that takes place has to be put squarely on the shoulders of the person who made those decisions at sea level. So in the short and long of it, there's a lot of different stories that come out of the David Sharp story. Apparently, Russell Bryce's Sherpas went there to move the body out of sight at the bequest of the parents. So that's it for my take on the David Sharp story. Very, very sad story. A bright young man with a pretty cool future ahead of him just was gobbled up and consumed by his desire, his absolute obsession, his passion to get to the summit of Mount Everest. And even with that, we still don't know if he even made it or not on the day that he died. There's always so many interesting comments and a discussion that takes place with stories like this, and I'd love to know what you think. So in the meantime, if you haven't already, hit that subscribe button. Thanks for taking the time to watch. Take good care of yourself. Do somebody a kind favor. Ask for nothing in return. Make the world a better place, one step at a time. Thanks for being here.